Hello, welcome to the Citywire Funds Fanatic podcast. My name is Gavin Lumsden. China has very much been in the news this year as the place where the COVID-19 pandemic began, but also for the increasing tensions the world's second largest economy is having with the other superpower, the US. With me to discuss all this and what it's like to actually invest in the country is Dale Nichols, manager of Fidelity China Special Situations, a £1.6 billion investment trust originally launched by Anthony Bolton in April 2010, but which Dale took on 6 years ago. Thanks for coming in, Dale.
Thanks, Gavin.
Now, like a typical journalist, I've dwelt on the negatives already, but the positives are that there's been an incredible rebound in China's stock market since March. The trust shares are up 39% year to date, which seems remarkable given the turmoil we've seen in stock markets. How do we square that with the fact that the world has been plunged into a coronavirus recession?
Yeah, it is interesting. I think on, you know, with regard to the US relationship, as I think I've talked about in the past, I mean, I think the friction, I mean, it has been there. I think it's going to be really with us for decades, really, as China emerges. As you know, for me in the trust, I focus very much, you know, on the domestic opportunity in China. And, you know, a lot of the companies that we're looking at, you know, are simply, you know, not going to be impacted by these tensions. Now, you know, in sort of interpreting, you know, what's driven the market up, you know, I think you could, you know, perhaps, you know, assume that that, you know, the market is sort of coming to the same realization that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the consumption story in China is very strong, you know, sort of driven by the natural development of the middle class, and perhaps the market's, you know, realizing that, you know, a lot of the companies are said to benefit from those trends. I think it's also fair to say that, you know, on a relative basis, you know, obviously the country has done a pretty good job of containing the virus and, you know, is clearly on the path to recovery, which probably contrasts pretty well with a lot of countries that are out there. So I think on a relative basis, you know, the fact that you know, many of the businesses are in sort of recovery mode is probably a driver as well.
And that's very interesting. Thank you. But can you give us, I think we're speaking a day before second quarter GDP economic data is due to come out from China. The first quarter data was, I think, positively received. How have you seen the overall economy responding to the coronavirus and then, you know, the kind of new economy that you're seeking to tap into?
Yeah. You know, obviously we're sort of out there talking to companies on a daily basis. It really does vary by industry in terms of the pace of recovery. You know, as you've mentioned, there are lots of companies and industries in China that have seen a boost from, you know, from the virus. You know, people spending more time at home. You know, that shift online, you know, across a range of sectors, not just shopping, but, you know, whether it's education, gaming, etc., you know, has you know, was already you know, that was already growing pretty strongly, but that growth has accelerated. So those, you know, I think we look at numbers from a lot of companies in that space, you know, there's you know, actually been fairly strong trends. Now, outside of that, in the manufacturing related areas, I think the recovery was pretty fast. When we were talking to companies late March, early April, the sense was on the manufacturing side that a lot of companies were already pretty much back to full capacity. On the services side, it's definitely been slower, and not surprisingly. So, you know, anything travel related has been hit pretty hard, as you can imagine. You know, particularly on an international sense, because it's really, you know, there's really no activity there. When it comes to, you know, things like restaurants, hotels, that sort of thing, most of the companies that I'm talking to are still down. So a lot of the restaurants, you'll find the numbers probably down between, you know, 10 to 30%. You know, some of the more hot formats, I'm hearing some numbers that have sort of moved into positive territory, but still generally down. And in hotels, you know, again, recovering, but still depending on the category, particularly the luxury end, is still relatively weak in terms of occupancy. But again, the general trend is one of recovery. In sort of broader retail, again, it varies by sector. I think, you know, probably one relatively bright spot has been in autos. Although I think we saw the June numbers that were down, I think the general trend is recovery. I think they were up relative to May. And within that, you know, we continue to see that shift towards more premium type products, the premium part of the market, which, you know, had already outperformed the broader market, has recovered faster as well. I was just going to finish off by saying some of the dealers that we're talking to are back in positive territory.
Oh, that's fantastic. So how did you respond when the crisis struck China earlier than it did in the UK and in the West? But when the stock market was falling, how did you respond? Were you selling out of those areas that were badly exposed, like travel and hotels, and then shifting more money into the consumer stocks, the digital stocks?
The first thing that you're doing is obviously trying to evaluate the impact on businesses. So as we're sort of heading into shutdown, you're thinking about companies' ability to sort of withstand a period of no revenues for some of the companies. So that sort of basic analysis of balance sheets and making sure the companies can survive the downturn and sort of loss of revenues, I think was the first thing. And then again, as you've said, that sort of analysis of how companies are, how earnings are going to be impacted. But I think, more importantly was really thinking about how things are going to change longer term. As you know, markets react pretty quickly. So, those sort of travel related areas, obviously, and areas like, the casinos, et cetera, you could see we're going to get hit pretty hard. I did some initial selling, but I think for a lot of the companies, you saw that get priced in pretty quickly into stock. So then you sort of move to a phase of really just thinking about, long-term value of companies, what's priced in, what's not. So one was sort of reducing some of those names. I reduced some companies that, where I was obviously thinking about the potential for rising bad debt, that sort of thing, the companies that could be impacted by that. Not that I own any banks, but there are some financials. I actually put some, added to some put options, some index put options, just to sort of, potentially pad the downside if we did see a deep correction.
Just to explain, Dale, could you just explain that a bit more? So that's a defensive thing. You're buying put options on the Chinese stock market index so that if it falls below a certain level, you still make a gain. Is that?
That's right. So on some of the indices in Hong Kong, just buying some put options, that I felt was sort of reasonably priced, that can add some protection if we did see a significant correction. This is in the early days, really the early days when we just sort of the cases were coming out in China.
And have you added any more of those put options recently? Given the strong run there's been, are there any concerns that it's getting a little overheated, or is it just part a natural rebound from what was a big fall?
I have actually, just given the move up. So, those earlier positions, sort of a number of those were in the money, so closed those. I think, that's what sort of brought down the gearing of the portfolio. But, given the sort of correction that we saw in markets, there was a lot of value presented. So that was an opportunity to increase some of the longs in the portfolio. Sort of that's what's driven gearing up over time, along with the addition of one more unlisted position in the portfolio. But you're right, we've seen a pretty strong recovery. I think risk reward. I'm still finding a lot of value out there in the market. But at the same time, it's probably not as much as there was, a few months back. So I've actually added. I have added a little bit more protection as markets have moved up. And that's, you know, again, that comes through in sort of overall gearing the portfolio, which has moved down of late.
Okay. And I'm just wondering, how did you actually visit companies, keep in touch with companies that you invest in or thinking about investing in, you know, during the lockdown?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. As you know, meeting companies is a real core part of the process, my process, and for Fidelity as a firm, just really staying in touch with companies, and it's a core part of the way we sort of analyze industries in general. It's been a challenge, but I've got to say, I think, you know, overall, it's been a relatively positive experience. I don't think it's the same as sitting across from someone. But, you know, I think we've been positively surprised with, you know, how the process has played out. I would say as well, I'm encouraged by the way the companies have responded as well. We do find that, you know, the companies have been pretty amenable to do more meetings online. That downside of not being able to sort of sit across from companies, the offset to that is, you know, you can clearly do more. China's a big country, so getting out to, you know, different parts of the country, to meet with companies, it can be challenging at times. So I think all of us are definitely working harder in actual meetings and getting more done. So overall, I think, you know, the process has been okay in terms of, you know, our basic investment and process.
Yeah. Now you and the team are based in Hong Kong. Is that right?
That's right. But the analysts, there's a core group here in Hong Kong, and then there's a team in Shanghai as well. And then I think we have some analysts and some other officers who have some China exposure as well. But the core group really would be in Hong Kong and in Shanghai.
Okay. What's it like being living and working in Hong Kong throughout the social unrest there's been in the past year or so, student protests, the democracy protests, and then most recently protests over the security law that China passed? Is it a frightening place to be at the moment, or how does it feel?
It doesn't feel as bad as you might sort of get the feeling from some of the images you see on TV. I think for most of us working here, it's been fine. It's definitely more unrest than we're used to. I think a lot of the businesses are pretty unsettled by things and keen to, you know, get back to sort of more normal business. As a place to work and operate, I've got to say it's been fine.
You mentioned the tensions with the US, but what about between China and the UK? The UK is telling telecoms companies here to strip out Huawei technology from next year, and, you know, that's annoyed China a lot. Have you got any concern that that might affect, you know, your ability to operate and see companies? Given you're running a London listed investment trust investment company.
I don't think so. When we're sort of engaging with companies, they're, you know, very much focused on getting back to business, getting on with business. That's more of the focus that comes through. And as we've discussed, I'm very much focused on the domestic opportunity in China. I can't think of a case where it's really, really sort of, you know, come into the conversation, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, actually, is it the case on a kind of fundamental level that, yeah, you're focused on this domestic opportunity, the kind of internal China, the growth of the middle class, and that's the big investment story, and investors who invest in the trust are sort of, you know, backing you to do that well. And that if you invest in a trust or a fund like Fidelity China, you know, you have to accept that there's going to be, you know, a lot of noise and volatility at the kind of, you know, macro economic and sort of political superpower level. But that's something that you shouldn't worry about too much. Is that basically the position?
I think you're right. It's, you know, as you know, when you're investing in China, you're dealing with headlines really on a daily basis. But as an investor, I found that over time and over the years investing in China, that can really create opportunities because there's so much real structural change that's happening on the ground, you know, in China. And so, you know, there's obviously the sort of basic economic backdrop, although growth is slowing, is still relatively positive. Whatever the final number for growth is in China, as we shift towards a more consumption-driven economy, I think you can rely on the fact that consumption is going to be growing faster. And we're focused on the companies that are going to take share in that environment. So there's, you know, it's actually sort of a pretty good backdrop for growth and finding companies and what's sort of, you know, there's a lot of innovative companies out there. And yet because of these headlines, you've found that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of fear out there that has sort of in many times driven valuations to relatively, you know, attractive levels. And if you believe that, you know, really stock prices follow earnings and, you know, the operating performance of companies over time, that can create, you know, pretty good opportunities actually in the market.
I mentioned that you've been running the trust Fidelity China Special Situations for 6 years, but you've been working and investing in the country and the region for longer than that. How long have you been a fund manager in the region?
So, you know, first as an analyst, but as a fund manager, it would have been since 2003.
Right. Okay. And so that's a good long stretch. What changes have you noticed in China over that time?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, a huge period of growth over time. And I think, you know, I could talk to a number of things, but, you know, I think the emergence of new China, you know, so these growing, you know, I talked earlier about the sort of different growth rates in different parts and sort of structural change that you're seeing. You know, I think, you know, the new China, which I'd put, you know, a lot of the consumption categories, obviously the whole tech space and areas like healthcare, that continues to just, you know, occupy a bigger part of, you know, the broader economy in general, and clearly in markets as well. So, you know, in the early days, you'd be looking at, you know, a stock market made up mostly of big SOEs concentrated in areas like energy, banking, telecom. You know, just look at what's happened really in the last 10 years with the emergence of the Alibabas and the Tencents, et cetera, which, you know, obviously strong in the tech space, but occupying just bigger parts, broader parts of the economy as well. And these are big, you know, innovative companies that are growing strongly, hiring strongly. You know, those types of categories, you know, those areas that just continue to increase. And grow strongly. And you know, I think in areas like, you know, in technology, you know, I mean, the shift to things like e-commerce is obviously something we're seeing happening globally. But, you know, e-commerce penetration in China is already well above the West and still growing faster. So, you know, those shifts, I think, you know, are just happening faster. The payment systems, you know, et cetera, really no one is using cash these days. Everything is, you know, Alipay, Tenpay. Or WeChat Pay, and you know, so I think, you know, that they're the things that I think, you know, really, really, really stand out. I think also you're seeing a more sophisticated consumer. I talked about earlier about, you know, the way you're seeing the strength of the premium brands within the overall auto space. I mean, you know, the overall auto market still has a lot of growth potential when you think about it from a penetration perspective. But even within that, you know, that shift to, you know, the premium brands, you know, is, I think, you know, interesting trend. And we see that across a range of categories. You're seeing, you know, that sort of upmarket shift, premiumization, and the emergence of stronger domestic brands, in the market as well. That's something that I think I'd highlight as well.
Okay, you mentioned Tencent and Alibaba, and they're two of the biggest holdings in the portfolio.
Right.
You know, it is striking how I just wonder. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the difference in development of e-commerce. You know, why it's taken off in China to such an extent and to a greater extent than in the West. Why do you think that was?
I think in e-commerce, I think you just in many parts, particularly in areas like third and fourth tier cities, you just haven't had the same retail build out that we had in the West, however many years ago. So I think in that sense, it's just easier for consumers to make that transition. You didn't have that sort of, again, that sort of legacy brick and mortar infrastructure, that other countries have gone through. So I think in those types of areas, it's easier to make that transition. But also, you can't really take anything away from really innovative companies that are operating in a sort of hyper competitive environment, targeting these consumers and their levels of innovation. To drive that shift as well, and these trends just now have a lot of momentum.
We've been focusing on your investments in the stock market in quoted companies, but 6% of the trust is invested in unquoted companies, unlisted companies that are yet to join the stock market. That's a big trend here in the UK, as you know. And is it something you're planning to do more of? Are you seeing as many opportunities in the unquoted space as you are on stock markets, or what's the proportion?
Yeah, I think this focus, or this ability that we have in the trust to invest in unlisted companies is something that's really positive. There's a huge amount of entrepreneurial activity, in China at the pre-IPO stage, the private company stage. I also think, it's fair to say, sort of globally, companies are coming to market later. So having the ability to invest in those companies is something that's really positive. And obviously, we've been able to benefit from that, owning companies like Alibaba, Meituan, et cetera, before their listing. It's clearly sort of helped, in terms of performance. There continues to be more opportunity, absolutely. In the tech space, but also in areas like healthcare. I think there's again a lot of entrepreneurial activity in that area, significant investment in R&D that has good potential to reap rewards going forward. So we continue to look at opportunities in that area, and I think there's good potential for us to increase those holdings over time.
Because one of the holdings is ByteDance, which is the operator of the very popular, globally popular TikTok platform, social media platform. Is that the most valuable by the long way of the half a dozen or so unlisted investments?
I would think so. Of those holdings, that would be the one that at least from a market cap perspective has the potential to definitely be the biggest. They're doing an amazing job of growing the business globally, but in China in particular. They've got the Douyin brand in China, TikTok overseas. That has just continued to march along, and they've shown the ability to monetize it. They're getting significant advertising revenues. A significant portion of the sort of online advertising revenues in China, less so overseas in terms of monetization. But the potential is definitely there as well in the long term.
What about your other sort of well-known unquoted investment, Didi, the ride-hailing app? That's not that's not an area that's well known for making profits. How are they monetizing things at the moment?
Well, Didi is actually quite profitable in their core business in China. They're unlike many other markets for ride hailing. They're the clear market leader with over 90% market share. Very much a stranglehold on the market in China. So, they're clearly benefiting from that market dominance, and so actually quite profitable in their core ride-hailing business. I think, like, you know, their ride-hailing peers globally, you know, earlier in the year they've seen a, you know, pretty significant drop-off in traffic, you know, as sort of, you know, they've come through the virus and dealing with the virus, obviously less rides, you know, delivered. But, you know, the sense is we get the businesses coming back pretty strongly for them.
Okay, that's that makes sense. And just a completely different kind of holding, but just we've got wealth managers in the audience and investors who might use wealth managers. I noticed that one of the stocks you invest in is a company called Noah Holdings. It's described as a wealth manager. Is that the kind of wealth manager that we would recognise in the UK, a sort of stockbroker, advisor of investments, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some overlap there, and I'll just sort of step back by saying, I mean, I think, you know, financial services is another area of huge potential growth in China. You know, sort of I think it's relatively underdeveloped to what we've seen, you know, the way we've seen markets develop in the West. So there's really good potential, you know, for them to grow. And so Noah is one of the larger independent players. Has shown, you know, a really, you know, strong propensity to build trust with their clients, to vet product. You know, it's a combination of you know, internal product, you know, that they're developing themselves and external. But on both sides, you know, really good growth potential, and you know, I think I'm quite positive on the potential for this company to grow to be, you know, much bigger over the midterm.
Okay, interesting. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on it. Dale, I'm getting towards the end of my questions, but I'm just sort of changing tack again, but looking as an overview. I mean, China is obviously an enormous country and gives you lots of scope in which to invest. But from a UK investor's point of view, you know, China is very interesting. But another single country funds that crop up on people's radar when they look at the region is Vietnam. There's a few investment companies specializing in that country. But there's a lot of talk about how, you know, Vietnam is benefiting from, you know, as China develops and its consumer economy grows and wages go up, that more companies, more manufacturers are moving their operations from China to Vietnam. Do you have any regrets that you can't invest in Vietnam? Is it benefiting at China's expense?
I actually, through my other funds, I do invest in Vietnam, and it's an interesting market. You know, there's a lot of the same drivers are there. It's earlier stage. And now liquidity has improved, so it's becoming a more interesting market, definitely. But I do feel that, you know, that sometimes some you know, when I hear some people talking about, you know so much capacity shifting to Vietnam, you sort of lose perspective of the scale in China. You know, the scale of the supply chain in China is massive. And, you know, I think incrementally at the margin, you know, companies will look to, you know, add capacity there. And it happens with companies that I talk to, you know, some of the Chinese companies, when they're making incremental capacity decisions, you know, Vietnam is definitely an option. But, you know, the sheer scale of the supply chain in China, you know, you just wouldn't have the capacity in some of these other markets to see capacity move in any sort of whole scale, you know, wholesale fashion, you know, to these markets. So, yeah, definitely an interesting market, but, you know, there's still, you know, when you just think of the sheer scale of China, again, in terms of manufacturing capacity, but also, you know, just in terms of, you know, the consumer, the development of some really, really, you know, significantly competitive companies that are going global. You know, I think there's really still a huge opportunity.
Okay, well, back to China for my last question. The trust marked its 10th anniversary early this year, and a decade is a good long time to prove a concept. So, looking at the performance figures on the trust fact sheet, to the end of May, the 10 years to the end of May, the shares delivered a total return in sterling of about 161%, which was some way ahead of the MSCI China index, which is the benchmark, which basically got 99% of double people's money. So people looking at that might think, well, you know, you've done well. The trust has done well. But that's in the past. So what about future performance? I mean, you've proved the concept, but could the next 10 years see similar returns, or has the best been achieved already?
I think, you know, as I said earlier, I'm still finding, you know, significant opportunity in China at reasonable valuation. You know, there are parts of the market that, you know, that are sort of not as attractive as they, you know, as they were, you know, in the past. But as I said, it's a very diverse market. You know, I think inefficient in many ways, you know, very, you know, significant variance in sort of growth rates and opportunity in different parts of the market. So if you're selective, you know, I think there's real opportunities. And you know, again, I find, you know, there's parts of the market that I feel are still neglected, undervalued. And, you know, as long as these companies can execute over time, you know, the hope is that gets recognized by the market as it has in the past.
Oh, well, it sounds like there could be a lot more to come. But you obviously have to think as an investor, you have to be prepared to invest for the long term and be prepared for some lots of downs as well as ups. Dale, thanks very much for spending the time with me. Very interesting discussion. And we look forward to catching up with you at a later date. Meantime, thanks very much.
Thanks, Gavin.